Hello, this is Byron Sawanek. This is number 0252 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0252. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet National Geographic filmmaker Brian Armstrong, who is the author of The Exotic Booze Club, True Adventures of Volcanoes, Cobras, and a Beer Elephant.
All the adventurers and cameramen and producers coming back from these exotic places in the field, I'd charge them with bringing back a bottle of the local exotic alcohol so we could sit in my office and drink it. We did that for about 6 or 7 years, and of course, along with the booze came some incredible stories, and the book is behind the scenes of these stories of making films for National Geographic and as seen through the bottom of a shot glass.
Anthony Del Call is one of the creators of Kill Shakespeare, the graphic novel series that has now been turned into a stage play, radio play, and even a board game.
Yeah, the dream that we had hoped would come true would be exactly where we are right now, which is the comic book series being very well received by critics, being very well regarded by fans and readers, and then, yeah, expand into different media. So, you know, we originally conceived it hopefully as something that would be comic books and film or television and video games, and we're actually on our way for that. But along the way, I mean, there are things that have come up like a board game and a stage show, which really weren't part of those original dreams, but they have quickly become a very positive reality.
Stuart Nallman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nallman, and Book Banter marks 75 years of honoring baseball's greats with The Hall. So get your induction speech ready. We're going to Cooperstown. It's all happening later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0252, was Byron Sawanek, who is a graphic artist at Global News in Edmonton. Thank you very much, Byron, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, picture this as a series of texts. What are you wearing right now? A surgical mask and smock. Kinky. Okay, that's not exactly a transcript, but it could be. The Washington State Medical Quality Assurance Commission says it has suspended the license of a Seattle anesthesiologist accused of frequently exchanging sexually explicit texts during surgeries. A statement issued by the state health department said Dr. Arthur K. Zilberstein is accused by the commission of compromising patient safety by his preoccupation with sexual matters while he was on duty at the hospital. Now, if you think that's just a little too weird, then wait. In addition to the allegation of sexting during surgeries when he was the responsible anesthesiologist, the commission has accused Zilberstein of inappropriately accessing medical record imaging for sexual gratification and having sexual encounters at the workplace. In other words, this guy gets hot and bothered looking at an X-ray. Wow. How do you develop that fetish? And by the way, back to the sexting. In an environment that is supposed to be completely sterile, who is allowed to bring a cell phone into an operating room? Yeah, I don't know either. Anyway, moving right along, Australian police arrested a man and charged him with drunk driving after he was found riding a motorized beer cooler while under the influence of alcohol. Well, it is a beer cooler. Anyway, the 22-year-old was driving the cart down the middle of a quiet street in the suburbs. The motorized cooler, known in Australia as an esky, did contain alcohol at the time. Well, again, it's a beer cooler. Yeah. This motorized vehicle would only be able to travel at very low speeds. The lighting devices on it would be negligible and make it very difficult for other motorists to see, according to police in a statement. Other Australians have been arrested for operating Eskies while intoxicated in the past. A 38-year-old man was arrested for drunk driving during a trip with his motorized cooler back in March. And a 23-year-old lost his license for 9 months following a 2011 Esky incident. In the 2011 case, the young man took his extreme cooler for a test drive on a main road. You know, perhaps the problem here is that people are actually making motorized beer coolers. You're just asking for trouble when you do that. Okay, moving right along, I have to paraphrase this next story by saying that I am a raging carnivore. Yes, a meat eater. I have no time for salads, but this story amuses me. A Florida man was arrested on a prostitution charge after he allegedly offered to exchange some green for sex during a reverse prostitution sting by the Daytona Beach Police Department. The thing is, the only green that Alonzo Liverman had was a salad from Applebee's. The 29-year-old wasn't the only one to get busted, and the DBPD arrested 9 other men, including former Florida State basketball player Tim Pickett. Now, during an encounter with an undercover female officer, Liverman replied, "I got a salad," after she said, "I'm hungry. You got food?" According to the arrest report, in exchange for the salad, the officer offered to give Liverman, I can't say the sex act on the air. Let's just call it the full Lewinsky. Yeah. Liverman consented to the deal and asked, "You ready to go?" Liverman was sentenced to 2 days in jail and fined $500 after pleading no contest to a misdemeanor charge. You know, there's an Applebee commercial tagline you don't ever want to hear. Just how good is an Applebee's salad? Well... And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, excuses, excuses, excuses. A Chinese man who got his penis stuck in an air conditioning pipe waited 2 days before seeking medical attention because he was embarrassed. Oh, I'm sorry, you didn't hear that? Let me repeat that. A Chinese man who got his penis stuck in an air conditioning pipe. Yeah, you heard right the first time. Anyway. Lian Tian told doctors that he slipped and got stuck in the pipe while painting in the nude in Guangzhou. The 61-year-old did not think people would believe him and only went to the hospital after he experienced swelling and developed a fever. "I thought that no one would believe me, and I tried everything I could think of to get the damn thing off once it got stuck," Tian said. "I cut it from the wall and tried pouring oil and liquid soap down the sides, but my manhood was so tightly wedged that nothing dripped down." Is he actually bragging here? I don't know. "Anyway, I went to sleep thinking that if I relaxed, it would slide off, but it didn't." Is he bragging again? "It began to get red and inflamed. I was worried that I would get a terrible infection. Doctors were unable to treat Tien, so they called in the fire brigade. It took firefighters 4 hours to remove the pipe from around Tien's genitals." Yeah. Is anybody buying the painting in the nude story here? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Brian Armstrong is a top National Geographic filmmaker and adventurer. He's also the author of The Exotic Booze Club, True Adventures of Volcanoes, Cobras, and a Beer Elephant. And Brian joins us on the line right now via Skype-to-Skype communications from the Washington, D.C. area. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
My pleasure.
It is, first of all, the subtitle is great. I mean, True Adventures of Volcanoes, Cobras, and a Beer Elephant. Those are things people don't normally work into a conversation.
Well, it's sort of been part of my life. I guess I'm a little more used to it now. But when you're out in the wilds and you really need a drink, you got to get it to you, you know, no matter what means it takes. Helicopter, beer elephant, camel, you name it.
Okay. Now, as I mentioned, you're a National Geographic filmmaker. I'm sure a lot of people are very familiar with your work. But what this book talks about, this exotic booze club, is basically adventures around the different brews you've managed to put together.
Yeah, it's a combination, really. I worked for Geographic for 11 years, and And I was an Australian. I was a bit of a fish out of the water there, and they had a very strict anti-alcohol policy, which, being the scallywag Aussie that I am, did not adhere to. And I started something called the Exotic Booze Club, so that all the adventurers and cameramen and producers coming back from these exotic places in the field, I'd charge them with bringing back a bottle of the local exotic alcohol, so we could sit in my office and drink it. So we did that for about 6 or 7 years. And of course, along with the booze came some incredible stories. And the book is behind the scenes of these stories of making films for National Geographic and as seen through the bottom of a shot glass.
Now, how do the folks at National Geographic, how did they feel, first of all, about what you were doing? Because I suppose they weren't too keen on it. And about this book?
Well, yeah, two-step question. Initially, it was a little cloak and dagger. It was undercover. And then the president at the time of National Geographic happened to discover it walking down the hall one day when we thought we were all in trouble. And it turned out he came in and loved it. And he used to be a regular, come in and rubbing shoulders. And it was that one place where you could be sitting next to an intern or a president or an explorer and just have this common bond over good stories and alcohol. So he, the HR department didn't like it when they found out about it, but I think he managed to talk them into letting us stay for a while. And then the book, we had to do some negotiations over the book, but Geographic doesn't come off looking too bad in the whole thing, for sure. It's a fantastic place to work and afforded me some incredible adventures and stories, like I said. So they tolerated the book just like they tolerated the club. A little uncomfortable for some of them, but, you know, we snuck by.
Well, you know, people always talk about in businesses, if you want to kill a buzz in an office situation, talk to the accountants. That's not true. I think you hit the nail on the head. It is HR.
Right. Yes. Yes. It's true enough.
Now, these exotic boozes, the various brews that you've had a chance to drink, were any of them any good? Were some of them horrible? What were you expecting? What did you get?
Well, over the course of the club, we had about 128, I think, different types of alcohol. And exotic is most of them were exotic, but what made them exotic may be where they came from, the type of bottle, the eviscerated snake that is lying around the bottom of it. It could be many things. And it sounds wonderful, but the truth is, most of these concoctions were really vile. They were, they were not made with expert care at all. And occasionally you'd get something, maybe from somewhere a little more civilized, like South Africa, say, and you'd find something quite delicious, or some of the monk-made chartreuse from France, and that would be definitely worth sampling. But a whole bunch of them were just experiences to taste and see what excuse people had for liquor in faraway lands.
Okay, you can't just gloss over eviscerated snake lying at the bottom. You got to explain that one.
Well, it's a funny thing that if most people in America and Canada and around the world are familiar with the grub and the worm in the bottle of the tequila. And that was actually only came about 50 years ago as a marketing technique. And it worked very well and done a good job of selling pretty bad, cheap tequila. But around the world, there are similar things. Some of them are more steeped in history than that. But there is, for example, the one I was talking about is in Japan. They use this habu snake, which is a very, very venomous, deadly snake there. And they eviscerate the snake and they put it in this bottle of sake, and they charge up $1,000 and up for a bottle of sake with the eviscerated remains of this habu snake in it. And you can get cheaper bottles where they've just kind of, where the alcohol has touched the snake and moved on. But if you want a bottle with the snake in it, it's supposed to be a bit like a Viagra, if you like, and they charge a lot extra for it, and they kill a lot of snakes for it. And as I've talked to you, I'm looking now at a bottle from Thailand of, reach up here, it's a silver rum shellback, and it's got a scorpion in the bottom of it.
Wow.
And it's a scorpion vodka, they call it. And they say they've taken the venom out of the scorpion, and they probably have. You guess. I haven't opened that one yet. I'm saving that one for a good occasion, but we'll see how that tastes.
At what point did this little office club of yours, at what point did you say, there's a book here, or did someone else tell you that?
No, it didn't. You know, I was on a way to a shoot. I was doing a story on the Appalachian Trail, and I was just traveling around with a young young assistant, and I was just telling her some stories, and she asked about the club, and it just dawned on me, because I knew there was always great stories behind the scenes of these stories we were telling. We're doing these documentaries about all kinds of crazy stuff, but often what you don't see or hear on TV is where the really good stories are. So I knew there were stories there, and then it suddenly occurred to me that I could link them together with the experience of the rise and fall of the Exotic Booze Club.
Ah, okay. Now, and that's one of the things that I've always found fascinating with cameramen in general. I work in television myself as a news anchor, and I go out and as a reporter, and television camera people are often the unsung heroes of what you do, because they're hardly ever seen. They put themselves in harm's way, nothing like what you do, I'm sure. I don't do that in an urban setting. But they never get the credit for what they do, and they usually have the best stories to tell.
Yeah, well, I've started shooting quite a bit myself, because often on these expeditions there's only room for one person and you have to do everything. But more often you do have a cameraman with you, and they become, you know, you're working on this thing so closely together, but they do become your shield in many ways, because you know no matter how hairy it gets, and we had some pretty close encounters with cobras and crocodiles and tornadoes and you name it, and helicopter crash at one stage, and it's always the cameraman who's really in peril. I can feel very brave standing there just a little bit behind them, but you know that you only have to outrun one person if a bear's chasing you, and then you're safe. So the cameraman we have a lot of respect for.
Yeah, you have to outrun one person, and he's the person usually carrying heavy equipment.
Yep, that's right. And they, and the funny thing happens when you start shooting too, and this has happened to me, when you're looking through the camera, you feel that little bit removed from what's happening in front of you. So you feel almost invincible. It's like there's a shield there, and you don't necessarily realize how close you are to danger till you're back having a drink afterwards and you look at the footage and you realize, oh my gosh, that was really close. And sometimes too close. We've definitely had a few people go down on these shoots. So it's a hairy thing. It's nice to definitely need the alcohol and the drink sometimes to wash away that stress of what you've been dealing with. But it's experiences you wouldn't trade for anything in the world.
And when camera people run, they will do anything they can to save their equipment.
Yes, and if they're good, and most of them are, they keep rolling. So whatever's chasing them, the camera's turned around and is filming what's coming after them.
The book is called The Exotic Booze Club, True Adventures of Volcanoes, Cobras, and a Beer Elephant. I'm just wondering, with this book now out, I'm guessing you have more stories to tell.
Yeah, there's a lot there that... weren't necessarily associated with alcohol. So I'm still thinking about how we can throw those ones in. But these are the definitely the best collection of adventures and expeditions I was on, and a real insight into what it takes to put these sort of shows together. And they are all linked by one of my fondest things, which is alcohol. So there's definitely a few there that that aren't linked by alcohol, but we'll have to save those for another day.
Would you definitely say this is an extension of just your Australian personality?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of larrikinism in it. I mean, I like to think of it as a humorous sort of tales. We tend to take a very laconic view at things, and this is definitely an extension of that.
Again, the book is called The Exotic Booze Club, True Adventures of Volcanoes, Cobras, and a Beer Elephant, written by Brian Armstrong. And Brian, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. My pleasure.
Brian Armstrong, author of The Exotic Booze Club, True Adventures of Volcanoes, Cobras, and a Beer Elephant. You can check out his website at theexoticboozeclub.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0252, and you'll find links to Brian's site, plus also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to one of the co-authors of Kill Shakespeare. Plus, Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter, and we do indeed have an idiot of the day. Plus, a lot more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program I also heard, well, you know, on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, the language columnist for the Baltimore Sun noted that his newspaper had referred to a 68-year-old woman in a report as elderly. He admitted that we should have known better than that, since the Associated Press stylebook dictates reporters should not, quote, refer to a person as elderly unless it is clearly relevant to the story, unquote. But on the other hand, columnist John McIntyre notes, if you are old enough to collect full Social Security benefits and Medicare, you are no longer young. For that matter, you are no longer middle-aged. And spare me the cod swallop about 60 being the new 40. I have been 40 and I have been 60, and I can tell one from the other, he said. Still, he advised his colleagues to steer clear from using the term elderly, since you know how cranky old people can get. Well, how do you know the Baltimore Sun has a lot of elderly readers? Simple. Because they still have a language columnist. Enough said. Okay, Lynn Rosenthal was arrested after allegedly driving to work under the influence of drugs, hitting a police car, hitting a median on the interstate, and crashing into the parking lot gates at the Broward County, Florida courthouse. She was arrested in the parking lot of the courthouse where she works as a circuit judge. She failed a field sobriety test but may not be charged because she did not appear to have been drinking alcohol. Rosenthal allegedly admitted to taking a sleeping pill the night before. Under Florida law, that drug is not listed as a controlled substance, according to defense attorney Michael Dye. It doesn't apply to Florida's impaired driving statute. Jara McLaurin, who was Rosenthal's opponent in an upcoming election, has concerns. If true, it would be disturbing to know she was about to take the bench and decide on people's fates under the influence, he said. On the other hand, that could put her up there right on the same level to deal with some of the great criminal minds of Florida. You know, like the folks who never bothered to figure out that a sleeping pill is a controlled substance. I mean, really? 19-year-old Manuel Herrera allegedly crashed into a traffic pole in Marysville, California. The pole, which had a red light enforcement camera attached, fell into the bed of his pickup truck, and Herrera allegedly sped off. He stopped a couple of miles from the crash scene and went back to adjust the camera in the truck and drove off again, but not before a witness caught him on camera. Officers caught Herrera at a friend's house, allegedly trying to get rid of the camera. He was arrested and charged of hit-and-run traffic collision and grand theft. Police say Herrera claimed he fled the scene because he was late for work. Well, he might be a few years late now. John Martin Novak, who is 48, of Buell, Idaho, said he needed sinus surgery to fix a snoring problem. He decided to do the surgery himself. Oh, that's never a good idea, is it? He described that he stuck two straws up his nose, the resulting police report says, and was attempting to break his own nose using a door that he would open rapidly and impact his face. Novak reportedly told officers that he had been drinking for a week to get ready for the procedures. Police were brought in after he allegedly threatened his sister with a rifle. Officers called in paramedics and Novak was hospitalized to bring his blood alcohol level down to safe levels. He was at 0.5%, which is getting close to lethal levels, and presumably to repair damage to his face. He was also taken to hospital for that, too. Now, wouldn't it be ironic if we ever found out that overly excessive drinking could lead to snoring? Just a thought. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, now here's a conundrum. The lionfish comes from the Indo-Pacific Ocean. Its mane is made of poisonous spines. Now, 10 years ago, it came to America, to the Gulf, and to the East Coast. And some scientists think this fishy immigrant and other invasive species should have stayed where they came from. Now, one proposal of getting rid of such invaders, eat them. The lionfish, it turns out, is buttery and can take the job of a lobster. But establishing invasive species as delicacies might undermine the mission of eliminating them. Nature Conservancy Texas Director Laura Huffman warns, eating invasive species is not a silver bullet. Hey, try them with garlic. Oh, as I said earlier, what a conundrum. I mean, you want to get rid of them, but you can't eat them. Because if you eat them and they're delicious, then you won't want to get rid of them. But then, while they're alive, they're also deadly, so you have to get rid of them. Oh, wow. It's the kind of endless logic loop that makes your head spin. And in the meantime, I'm suddenly kind of hungry. Yeah. Well, in the meantime, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? It's been a couple of years since we talked to Anthony Del Call on the program. He is one of the creators, along with Connor McCreary, of Kill Shakespeare, which was initially a 12-part comic book series featuring Shakespeare's most famous heroes. Well, they've come a long way. There's a stage play, a radio play, among other things, and there's soon to be a board game. So Anthony is back on the show via Skype to Skype communications from Toronto to talk about some of the more recent developments. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Peter. I'm so glad to be back on the program.
Glad to have you here. When we first started talking about this, when you first started planning all of this, was it your idea that it was going to be such a cottage industry, or were you just simply starting with a comic book?
Well, I mean, from the very get-go, Connor and I had hoped, you know, I mean, every now and then you sit down and you think about what an ideal circumstance or, you know, the, you know, what would a dream come true be? And yeah, the dream that we had hoped would come true would be exactly where we are right now, which is the comic book series being very well received by critics, being very well regarded by fans and readers, and then, yeah, expand into different media. So, you know, we originally conceived it hopefully as something that would be comic books and film or television and video games, and we're actually on our way for that. But along the way, I mean, there are things that have come up like a board game and a stage show, which really weren't part of those original dreams, but they have quickly become a very positive reality.
Wow. So I know we talked about this in the past. One of the things about Shakespeare is it's considered the classics, obviously, but in high school, usually it's something that you're dragged into. You have brought what was initially a popular form of entertainment when Shakespeare first wrote it back to popularity in a way.
Well, thank you. I mean, we kind of, that sort of was the intent. I mean, you know, the intent was not to turn it into something with all these brand extensions, but really it was to create a product that would get people excited about Shakespeare in a whole new way. I mean, you are absolutely right. I mean, when people are first exposed to Shakespeare, unfortunately, in Western society, a lot of it is they go into kicking and screaming because it's taught by teachers that just, they're not excited by it themselves because they were taught Shakespeare by teachers that weren't excited. You know, it's one of those vicious circles. And I mean, yeah, we've tried to create something, especially with the comic book series, that could get people of all ages. I mean, whether you are 12 years old or 13 years old and just starting to read Shakespeare, or whether you're in your 60s or 70s or 80s that and have been a fan of Shakespeare your entire lives. I mean, just a whole new way of looking at these characters in a whole new way. And we kind of like the fact that Shakespeare is often perceived to be very highbrow, and comic books are perceived to be very lowbrow. So, you know, somehow it's kind of brought them, you know, they've kind of met somewhere in the middle.
I also find that interesting that some people think Shakespeare is very highbrow, when, again, if you go back to the time that Shakespeare wrote it, it wasn't.
You are absolutely right. I mean, when Shakespeare wrote his plays, I mean, he was the Steven Spielberg, the J.J. Abrams, the Stan Lee, you know, the U2 of his time. I mean, his plays appealed to everybody. They would appeal to the royalty that had their own private balcony up in the Globe Theater or any of the theaters that he would be showing his productions at. And they'd also appeal to the average person. They have everything in them. That's why. I mean, they not only do they have great characters, but they've got, you know, the raunchy, rowdy comedy. They've got the violence that appeal to to a wide spectrum of people. And they also have those tender moments. I mean, that's why we Connor and I often argue that Shakespeare is not only the greatest writer of all time, but the greatest entertainer of all time.
Do you hear from those in the so-called highbrow community who don't necessarily appreciate what you've done with Shakespeare?
That was the segment of the population that, to be honest, we were quite afraid of when we first started the project. We were afraid that they would look at it and go, well, these guys don't really know their Shakespeare. They have not studied. They don't have PhDs in English from Cambridge or Oxford or whatnot. But it's actually, we've got a lot of fans in academic communities. I mean, we've been written up by dozens of professors and academics that have analyzed it. We've attended the Shakespeare Association of America and gotten very very good reviews there. And yeah, I mean, everyone from people like Sir Tom Stoppard, who wrote Shakespeare in Love and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, through to Julie Taymor, who's done numerous Shakespeare projects. They're all fans of Kill Shakespeare.
Okay, when you started this, again, with the graphic novel or the comic book, you started with, was it 12 or 13 episodes or editions?
Yeah, it was originally slated to be just 12 issues. So we had 12 issues that came out, which were collected into two graphic novels. And that was back in, the first issue came out in April 2010, and the 12th issue came out in late 2011. And that's all we were going to do. But then because people wanted more, and along the way we discovered that there were so many other characters that we wanted to incorporate that we just weren't able to in the span of those 12 issues. So last year in 2013, we launched our sequel miniseries, The Tide of Blood. And then next week, actually, on June the 18th, we are launching our next sequel series, which will be culminated in our volume number 4, The Mask of Night.
Okay, and in addition to that, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, a board game is coming up, I guess, next month?
Yes. The exact release date is still to be determined. Most of it has been printed. We're just waiting for one or two little segments from the printer. But yeah, I mean, that was one of those things that we just didn't... It wasn't part of our original plan, but IDW Publishing, our publishing company, they created a board game division late last year, and we were the first title that they wanted to put out. So they approached us. We decided on the right terms, and then they hired two fantastic designers out from Belgium who've put together a number of critically acclaimed board games. And yeah, we've tried to capture that the whole Kill Shakespeare experience, where you can select one of five characters, Hamlet, Juliet, Othello, Falstaff, or Viola, and you get to basically, you work with the other people to ensure that Richard III and Lady Macbeth do not take over all of the Illyria, which is the land, and get to William Shakespeare, the magical wizard, first.
Wow. Now, besides coming up with board game designers and working on this, what kind of input do you and Connor have in putting together the board game, or on how it's played?
Well, one of the great things about Kill Shakespeare thus far is, I mean, the collaborative process. I mean, not only in the comic book, working with Andy Belanger, who's an amazing artist and has done every single page of our series thus far, but I mean, you know, working with Soul Pepper Theater, who put together the original stage production, and through to the board game. And with the board game, I mean, we have been involved hands-on in terms of any story decision. We actually write every single mission or every single journey that takes place in the board game. We sign off on all the artwork. We decide which characters are there, what the overall story is, the instruction manual. I mean, we're there now. I don't want to say, of course, that we've done it all, because neither Connor nor I have put together a board game before, and that's where we kind of leave a lot of it to the professionals to do.
You mentioned what Shakespeare would be like if he were, you know, he was the Spielberg or that type of person of his day. What do you think William Shakespeare would think of all that you guys have accomplished with his work?
Well, I mean, Shakespeare himself actually took a lot of his ideas from already pre-existing plays, pre-existing stories that were out there. So, I mean, I think you kind of look at it and go, well, guys, that's pretty good. You kind of aped my style, and you've also aped my technique in terms of coming up with stories. But then, of course, he'd get his lawyers on board, and then they would sue us. But, of course, you know, in court, I would dramatically rise up and quote, you know, his line, kill all the lawyers, and therefore, I guess that would turn the entire case moot. So I think we win at the end of the day.
Plus, you'd also have to deal with Sir Francis Bacon as well.
Either Sir Francis Bacon or Edward De Vere, all those others. Yeah, you're right. They would all be character witnesses against Mr. Shakespeare.
Okay. This, again, you've done amazingly well with this. I mean, who would have envisioned a board game when you first started all this? So is the sky still the limit? Are there things you want to do with Shakespeare and with Kill Shakespeare that you haven't done yet?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have a stage production, which is a live, basically a live reading of the first 12 issues of the series. And that's toured in about two dozen cities worldwide, everywhere from Chicago and New York and Toronto through to Dubai in the Middle East. But I'd love to do a Broadway production one day. You know, I'm a big musical fan, so I'd love to do a big musical production. I want action figures. We've looked into it, and hopefully in the next couple of years we'll produce action figures of the Kill Shakespeare, our take on the characters in Kill Shakespeare. But the two biggest things I would love to see are a video game and a television series. And we're actually heading to LA next week for meetings with managers and agents. We have a lot of interest to adapt this into a Game of Thrones with Shakespeare's characters, and that's sort of the next big step in our journey.
Wow, that would be amazing. And I guess people can keep up and find out more information and about everything you're doing by going to the website, killshakespeare.com.
Exactly, killshakespeare.com. They can follow us on Twitter at killshakespeare. We're on Facebook. We're on Tumblr. All the usual suspects.
Anthony, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
No problem. Thank you very much, Peter. Like I said, it's a pleasure to be back on. You were actually one of the first people to interview us back in 2010 when we first launched our series, so it's great to be able to come home again.
Anthony Del Call, one of the creators of Kill Shakespeare. You can check out their website at killshakespeare.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0252, and you'll find the links to Anthony's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order their book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Who would ever think that a lawsuit involving ice cream could give us a lesson on why filing a lawsuit isn't always such a good idea? But it did, and here's the story. In the 1960s, a premium ice cream maker developed a unique marketing theme based on its Scandinavian-sounding name. 2 decades later, when another ice cream maker also started doing business under a Scandinavian name, the first company sued to force it to change its name. When the case finally made it to court, however, the New York-based creators of the first Scandinavian-sounding company admitted that their own name was actually made up and had no meaning in any language. Meanwhile, even though the second company was also based in the United States, its name was taken from a real Swedish phrase meaning frozen joy. Let's be fair, after these marketing secrets were revealed in court, the judge quickly put a deep freeze on the lawsuit. He said that since the first company didn't even have a real connection to Scandinavia, the lawsuit had no merit. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org. to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart is back once again with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. I hope you're ready to take a trip right now.
A trip where?
I thought we'd go somewhere in central New York State, the little town called Cooperstown.
Ah, the Baseball Hall of Fame.
That's it. That's a great spot. I've been there about 3-4 times myself, actually. You know, because it was exactly 75 years ago that the most hallowed site in professional baseball opened its doors to a large gathering of devoted fans, as well as many of the game's greatest players dominated the diamond from the 1890s to the 1930s. This wasn't Yankee Stadium, Fenway Park, or Wrigley Field. This was the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum in Cooperstown, the small town in central New York State where the game was allegedly created by Abram Doubleday in 1839.
Ah.
Yeah. Allegedly, but you know, but we'll stick to that story right there. Right
yeah,
now.
Because we don't want to be sued by anybody.
Exactly.
So let's use allegedly.
So to mark the 75th anniversary of the opening of the most highly regarded professional baseball shrine, the people at the Baseball Hall of Fame have utilized their vast encyclopedic knowledge, not to mention their massive photo archive, to come up with this impressive volume that's called The Hall, plain enough. That will certainly have fans appreciate the 300 inductees even more and spark more discussion and debate amongst their fellow baseball devotees. Now, while many of the books that deal with the Baseball Hall of Fame focus on the many artifacts that are displayed in the museum that tell the story of how baseball became the national pastime, the Hall places its emphasis on its raison d'etre, which is the 300 players, umpires, managers, and executives whose achievements on and off the baseball diamond earned them the right to be known as inductees, whose bronze plaques are displayed with pride in the museum's Hall of Honor and are viewed upon with awe by visitors of all ages every year as they make that baseball pilgrimage to Cooperstown. Now, instead of profiling each inductee according to the year they were elected, the book decided to profile them according to the field position they played during their baseball career, whether behind the plate, in the infield, the outfield, or on the mound and in the dugout, in which each inductee are profiled per chapter by order of the year of their election in a series of two-page mini bios, complete with photos and their Hall of Fame plaque. Now, each profile not only trumpets the numbers and the achievements that earned them their place in the Hall, but also offers some interesting gems of information that you may or may not have heard about your favorite the baseball legends.
Such as?
Well, Rogers Hornsby, the Raja, from the Cardinals in the 1920s. He won 7 National League titles during that time. He admitted he never went to movies and rarely read because he didn't want to strain his eyes that would affect his hitting at the plate. Or, speaking of the Cardinals, Stan Musial. He got his nickname The Man from Brooklyn Dodger fans for his offensive skills during the back-and-forth pennant race between the two teams during the 1946 season. And Ty Cobb, who was notorious for his dirty on-field tactics that earned him the hatred of his fellow American League players during the early 1900s, preached common sense eating and drinking buttermilk in order for ballplayers to have a long, productive career, which I guess explains his 23 years as a pro baseball player.
It's always interesting because when everyone talks about people who should or should not be in the Hall of Fame, you know, the whole Pete Rose debate, the whole players who were involved in the steroid scandals, it always comes up, well, look at some of the people who are in the Hall of Fame. And, of course, they always point to Ty Cobb.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was one of the first inductees, and he's like one of the first candidates who could not have been an inductee or maybe should not have been an inductee. But, you know, they looked at his achievements on the field than rather, you know, off the field. So, you know, case in point.
Yes, yes.
And each section is preceded by an essay written by a living Hall of Famer that represents each position. Like Nolan Ryan talks about pitchers, Cardinal Fisk writes about catchers, there's Jim Rice, Tommy Lasorda, etc. Now, each essay, which reads like a mini memoir, gives each legend their own personal story of how they developed their respective baseball careers, the people who were their inspirations, their accomplishments, pitfalls, and proudest moments, and what being a Hall of Fame inductee meant to them. In a time in pro sports where money, greed, and selfishness takes over many of its players, it's refreshing to read how these Hall of Famers earn their place in Cooperstown in quite a simple, honest, hardworking manner. And it's quite revealing for many of the other reasons than to spark controversy or to sell books.
Hmm.
Now, go ahead, Peter.
No, I was going to say, the book is?
It's The Hall.
Right.
And it's something for that baseball fans, where they have made the journey to Cooperstown or not, will treasure for the fitting tribute it bestows upon the 300 legendary individuals who are regarded as the greatest names who are put on a uniform and display their baseball prowess on the field.
And it's written by?
Well, it's written by the people at the Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, but there's a foreword by Tom Brokaw, and it's published by Little Brown, and it's $39.
And I know there are so many books out there that are baseball-based, and we've talked about many of them over the past several years, near, I say, decades. But I asked the question because we were talking about a baseball book. What other books do you recommend? Although I can guess what a few of them might be.
All right. I thought I'd take a little bit of a switch and read about there's books about there's a book I reviewed on Book Banter a while ago about the Football Hall of Fame, which last year celebrated its 50th anniversary. And there's a whole series of books that the Hockey Hall of Fame published, written by Andrew Podniak, who's quite the hockey expert. So the books about the Stanley Cup, books about hockey uniforms, books about retired uniforms, goaltenders, what have you. And also, if you're going to go to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, I do highly recommend that you buy their program book. It's a great publication, and every year that I've went, I've bought the editions. It profiles every inductee, talks about the history of the Hall of Fame. It's a beautiful program book. It goes for about $10.
If I'm going to put you on the spot right now,
yeah.
What would you say your favorite baseball book is?
I've read so many books on baseball, Peter. It's tough to say, but the first ones that I read that really, I got hooked on baseball was a book by Peter Golenbach called Bums, which was an oral history of the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Ah, you're going way back.
Yeah, no, yeah. This is around 1986, actually.
I'm going to go with either Leo DeRocher's Nice Guys Finish Last. I'm purposely not picking Ball 4 because everyone picks Ball 4, although it's a great book. But Leo DeRocher's Nice Guys Finish Last or The Umpire Strikes Back.
Oh, yeah. Ron Luciano.
Absolutely.
Very funny.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, this week's book is?
The Hall. It's by the good people at the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum with a foreword by Tom Brokaw, published by Little Brown. And it's $39.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, you can find, not under a rock, or maybe not the Hall of Fame, or on the diamond, you can find me at the Montreal Times in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Well, put me in, Coach. I'm ready to play.
Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about at a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have a few more Stuff File stories to share with you before we get to our Idiot of the Day. A Hamilton, Ohio man with a long history of public indecency convictions was arrested again for simulating sex with a pool float. 35-year-old Edwin Tobergta was arrested Wednesday morning after a witness observed him standing naked on Route 4 in Hamilton, simulating sex with a pink pool flotation device. According to the police report, the witness said he was in full view of nearby businesses and passing cars. He was charged with public indecency and contempt of court. Tobergta was previously arrested in June of 2013 after he engaged in sex with a pool float outside of his house and in front of several children. He pleaded guilty to that offense and was sentenced to 11 months in prison but was released early. In August of 2011, he was arrested for a similar offense involving having sex with a pink swimming pool raft. In 2002, he was caught having sex with an inflatable pumpkin that was part of a Halloween display. Believe me, this is not a guy whom you want to ask at the grocery store, paper or plastic. And by the way, what's he like when he's actually in a pool? That's what I want to know. Anyway, 47-year-old Susan Coppinger was promoted by the city of Boston in January to a job paying $38,800 in the Inspectional Services Department, even though a month earlier she had been arrested for bank robbery. In fact, police said it was her second robbery of the same bank in nearby Quincy, Massachusetts. Apparently, the city's human resources office doesn't monitor mugshots on the massmostwanted.com website. But in April, the city finally secured Susan's resignation. I'm sorry, but why does she have to resign? I mean, couldn't they just fire her ass outright? Seriously. Seriously. Anyway, this is when art gets weird for this next story. When 64-year-old Ayano Tsukimi moved from Osaka back to her home village of Nogoro, she found a population of only 37 people and set out to replace, and I'm doing air quotes here, replace those who had died or moved away by creating life-size stuffed dolls with unsettling facial features, which she positions around town as if to suggest a larger population. Tsukimi estimates that she has created about 350 inhabitants, according to a Global Post in May, and imagines a future where she's outlived all of her neighbors and only dolls remain. Yeah, there's nothing creepy about that. Yikes. And speaking of creepy, okay, we have two stories that show that there are definitely people out there in serious need of some help. Number one, Gregory Schwartz, age 40, was arrested in Claremont, California in March and charged with crawling under a ladies' restroom stall door at a Big Lots store to molest a shopper. And by the way, Schwartz was dressed as a Barbie doll. Yeah, he shouldn't be allowed out anymore. And story number two, Jeremy Grinnell, age 42, pleaded guilty in May in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to having popped up a ladder under a couple's bedroom window in November and climbed up to watch them have sex. At the time, Jeremy was a local pastor and assistant professor at Grand Rapids Theological Seminary. Yeah, he shouldn't be allowed out anymore either. And I could think of several passages in the Bible that he might have simply just glossed over. And finally, before we get to our idiot of the day, because we're getting very, very close to that, Dan Gredding, working on contract with the city of Santa Barbara, California, was busy at work in February one day, installing signs on street lamps warning that only 75-minute parking was permitted. On one block, three signs were called for, but the last one required Dan to drill into concrete, insert screws, and wait for the concrete to dry, which apparently took more than 75 minutes, and a passing police car ticketed his truck. Now, Dan's first appeal of the citation was denied, but a second appeal was pending at press time. Yes, there's nothing like idiocy in bureaucracy. I was almost willing to make this the idiot of the day, but I didn't, only because there are too many people up the chain of command that might be eligible along the way, and, as I said, at press time, there could be more. This story isn't over. However, this next story, well, this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
A 911 call at 1:50 a.m. on May 29th came from a man who said he was lost on Dean Still Road near Polk City, Florida, and being chased by wild hogs. Yes, a sheriff's deputy fairly easily rescued 24-year-old Andrew Joffrey, but then they discovered that A, Joffrey had an active arrest warrant, and B, was in possession of a GPS device that he admitted stealing from a car that evening. The Polk County Sheriff told reporters that it was unusual for an absconding thief with a warrant to bring himself to deputies' attention like that, but acknowledged with a wink that it does get pretty dark on Dean Street Road in the middle of the night. Yes. Well, why? Oh, why would any person, anyone who is wanted by police call 911 because he's lost, when he already has a GPS, which he just stole, by the way? Well, one reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0252. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0252. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.